Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Abby Maxman, CEO of Oxfam America, who examines the Trump regime's abrupt and chaotic closing down of U.S. Agency for International Development Programs and the hundreds of thousands of lives lost as a result. Chad Marlowe, Senior Policy Counsel with the ACLU, who warns that Donald Trump's National Security Memo 7 poses an unconstitutional threat to the president's political opponents, freedom of speech, and democracy itself. And artist and activist Robert Shetterly, creator of the Americans Who Tell the Truth Portraiture Project, honoring those who fought for justice, equality, and democracy, who explains his goal of inspiring courageous citizenship. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the hunt for critical minerals, President Donald Trump is increasingly looking abroad to shore up the U.S. supply of raw materials essential to many of the world's new technologies. From China to Ukraine to Greenland, Trump's foreign policy revolves around rare earth minerals and 17 metallic elements that are not actually that rare, but have been at the forefront of Washington's trade war with Beijing. Trump's aggressive push for American artificial intelligence world dominance has injected even more urgency into his scramble to access these minerals. That's because critical minerals aren't just needed to build clean energy technologies and advanced defense systems. They're also necessary to build mega data centers and AI infrastructure that the Trump administration is working to accelerate. As a result, the price of copper, where massive amounts of the metal are needed to build data centers, is predicted to increase. While China was headed toward monopolizing the global strategic mineral sector, the U.S. recruited 8 partner nations known as Pax Silica, which include Australia, Israel, Japan, the Netherlands, Singapore, South Korea, the United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. This new coalition aims to counter China by securing new critical mineral supply chains to boost artificial intelligence technologies. In a rare moment of unity, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum, and President Trump stood on stage together for the FIFA World Cup draw in early December when the schedule of team competition was announced. In a gesture geared to stroking Trump's ego, FIFA President Gianni Infantino awarded the president a special FIFA Peace Prize. In the coming months, Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. are set to review the North American Trade Agreement, or USMCA, signed by the 3 countries in 2020. However, Trump is raising doubts about the future of the treaty, the successor to the unpopular North American Free Trade Agreement. While the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and 500 business and agricultural groups support the USMCA, Trump has threatened to impose new tariffs on all imports from Canada and Mexico, which would jeopardize Washington's largest free trade agreement. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney's January speech at the World Economic Forum, calling on smaller nations to band together to challenge the economic coercion of great powers, a clear reference to Trump's imposition of global tariffs, could complicate USMCA negotiations, as has Carney's recent announcement of a new strategic trade partnership with the People's Republic of China. Over 480 days after Hurricane Helene hit North Carolina in September 2024, residents with damaged and uninhabitable homes are still waiting on the Federal Emergency Management Agency to process applications for a buyout. As of the end of December last year, no homeowner who applied for a full buyout had received assistance. FEMA-funded voluntary buyouts allow storm-impacted homeowners to receive the pre-disaster value for their properties. so that they can relocate and start over. This program has helped communities reduce overall flood risk. The buyout mandates that properties vulnerable to future storms are acquired by the government and turned into open space. Although President Trump promised to slash through every bureaucratic barrier to rebuild all North Carolina properties lost, more than 800 victims of Helene have had no response to their buyout applications. North Carolina Governor Josh Stein has called the paralysis absolutely unacceptable, protesting that further delay of these approvals keeps communities and families in limbo and, in some cases, paying expenses on homes they cannot live in while they await word from FEMA. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
When Donald Trump returned to the White House on January 20th, one of his first acts was to dismantle the United States Agency for International Development. With a budget of $35 billion, USAID had funded thousands of projects in more than 100 countries around the world for 60 years. Its most important projects included the delivery of food, medicine, and emergency supplies to those affected by conflict and natural disasters. The agency also funded and operated life-saving programs across the developing world that provided vaccinations and medicines to treat HIV/AIDS, malaria, projects to improve maternal health, sanitation, and contributed technical assistance for agriculture and to access clean water. The impact of the agency's official closure on July 1st has been felt around the world. A study published by the medical journal The Lancet on June 30th estimates that over the past 20 years, USAID programs have saved over 90 million lives. The researchers also estimated that if USAID's programs remain closed through 2030, 14 million people who might have otherwise lived could die, including 4.5 million children younger than 5 years old. Dr. Brooke Nichols, Associate Professor of Global Health at Boston University, estimates that the abrupt cuts to USAID programs had already resulted in more than 300,000 deaths as of late June. Your reporter spoke with Abby Maxman, Oxfam America's president and CEO, who examines the Trump regime's rapid and chaotic closing down of USAID programs and the hundreds of thousands of lives lost as a result.
Well, it has been exceptionally cruel and harmful and hurtful, and I would argue immoral and illegal as well. In the first days and months of this administration, they bragged about this notion of, quote, taking a chainsaw to U.S. humanitarian development and aid. And they continue to insist that no lives have been lost or being lost. The Lancet reported that these attacks stripped away programs that could cause an estimated 14 million deaths between now and 2030. And they also estimated that USAID, the U.S. foreign assistance arm of the U.S. government, those programs have saved, and there's evidence and decades of evidence, have saved over 90 million lives over the past two decades. So looking forward into the future, as we watch vital food, clean water, medicine, both disappearing, but in the early days, the cruelty was even worse because they just shuttered clinics and access and warehouses to aid that was already in process, already in motion, taken away from people without coordinating with local governments, local communities, nothing. It was chaotic in every way you could imagine. And so under the guise of efficiency and preventing waste, I don't think there could have been a more wasteful, more cruel, more harmful, and inefficient way of rolling out any kind of change or reform.
When I first heard about
DOGE and these major cuts to these vital USAID programs that so many lives were dependent on, I thought, why are they cutting this off abruptly rather than if their real goal was to save money in the U.S. budget, and it's not that big a part of the U.S. budget, we should say, but if that was the goal, why not work over a course of months to hand off these extremely important projects to maybe other European nations, other countries around the world, so they could take them over? This abrupt dropping of all these programs and closing of clinics, as you said, costing hundreds of thousands of lives, if not millions, seemed vengeful and vindictive. It was irrational in a way that you couldn't understand it in any other way.
Thank you for naming that, Scott. I have run out of adjectives to describe this. So vengeful, vindictive, all of those things are so apt in describing what we've seen, what we've witnessed. And there's so many different ways to do meaningful reform of anything. And it's, this way has been intentionally chaotic. I can't think, it seems intentionally chaotic, at least how we've experienced it, seen it, and had seen its impact roll out. And as you say, on the saving side of it, the U.S. support, and there's a misunderstanding that we and many others have been trying to help people, taxpayers in the U.S., who have, we all have a right and a responsibility to know what our taxes are going for. U.S. foreign assistance represented 1% of the U.S. budget. So even not just the way they've taken the chainsaw or the sledgehammer has been destructive, but the harm so disproportionately outweighs the savings. It's staggering if you just want to look at finances. And what's further troubling is that the $30 billion of assistance that goes to the UN and others in the humanitarian and development architecture, President Trump's tax cuts that he's pushing through are going to increase, be tax cuts that benefit $60 billion, double the amount of the savings to go into the pockets of the wealthiest 1% of taxpayers and these billionaires. So we're seeing this case of reverse Robin Hood. Stealing, taking food, clean water, life-saving support from the poor. Obviously, we know how it's rolling out in the United States as well. Similarly, taking support and services from the poor and doing so to give tax breaks for the ultra-rich. It's obscene.
That was Abby Maxman, Oxfam America's president and CEO. This interview was previously broadcast on October 1st last year. Learn more about the consequences of the Trump administration's rapid closure of USAID's humanitarian assistance and foreign aid programs by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Donald Trump deploys National Guard troops to Democratic Party-run cities across the country, he's taken other radical steps to consolidate his authoritarian rule by defying and circumventing the U.S. Constitution's establishment of three co-equal branches of government to act as a check on abuses of power. On September 22nd, not long after the assassination of far-right leader Charlie Kirk, Trump signed an executive order designating Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization, despite the fact that it's a decentralized movement whose only unifying ideology is its opposition of fascism and far-right extremism, lacking membership roles in a leadership hierarchy. Just 3 days later, Trump issued National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, which authorizes the FBI's National Joint Terrorism Task Forces to investigate, prosecute, and disrupt entities and individuals engaged in acts of political violence and intimidation, targeting nonprofits, activists, and their donors and funders labeled anti-American, anti-capitalist, and anti-Christian. Civil liberties groups have expressed alarm at Trump labeling his critics and political opponents engaged in protected First Amendment activities as domestic terrorists, which clearly seeks to criminalize dissent. Your reporter spoke with Chad Marlowe, senior policy counsel with the ACLU, who warns that Trump's National Security Memo 7 poses an unconstitutional threat to the president's political opponents, freedom of speech, and democracy itself.
To most people, to most of your listeners, they may not be familiar with what we refer to as NSPM 7. But I think what they are very familiar with is that the president of the United States has very little tolerance for people who do not share and fully embrace his views and are not enthusiastically supportive of his agenda and him personally. And so in that light, him handing down a memorandum instructing the federal government, in particular the Attorney General and the Secretaries of State, Treasury, and Homeland Security, to identify nonprofits and charitable foundations whose work does not completely align and take a gentle knee to Trump and his agenda as, you know, what he will refer to as people who are promoting domestic terrorism and political violence. But I do think you and your listeners and a lot of people out there realize that this is Trump just trying to pound a square peg into a round hole, which is to say that he still has enough acumen, I think, to not say, I'm going to bring the entire force of the federal government down on anyone who dares disagree with me. So he couches it in these vague terms, as you point out, like terrorism and political violence, knowing that when it comes to enforcement, loose terms equal latitude. And so that gives him the opportunity to go after whoever he wants to tie into those groups. You know, one of the things that that the memorandum specifically references as the type of politically motivated terrorist acts that he's going to clamp down on, so you're expecting big things, he includes trespassing. He includes civil disobedience, which he calls civil disorder. And in order to rope in nonprofits and charitable institutions, he says it's not only people who engage in those acts, but people who in any way support them, inspire them, talk about them. And so that is kind of the world that we're looking at is, you know, anyone who attempts to organize a protest can come into the bullseye of this. Any nonprofit who attempts to go out and support people who want to have a conversation about the direction of our country and, God forbid, may have an issue with the direction it's going, those, unfortunately, are all in the crosshairs of this memorandum.
You wrote an article titled, Governors and Mayors Can Protect Nonprofits from Trump's National Security Memo, NSPM 7, that labels his opponents as domestic terrorists. Tell us a bit about your advice to governors and mayors of cities who can do something to be proactive to defend citizens who are just exercising their constitutional rights from the effects of this memo.
One of the interesting things that appears in this memorandum is an acknowledgement that the people who are effectuating it, in particular, as you mentioned, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, who are kind of leading the effort, are going to have to work with state and local law enforcement in order to get what they need to go after these nonprofits and charitable institutions. That's not because they want to work with state and local entities. It's because they have to. Because a lot of the on-the-ground enforcement capabilities, and even more important, the information they need to try to dig up some pretextual reason to go after these, are in the hands of state and local governments. And this can be everything from highly sensitive and kind of on its face troubling surveillance data, but it can also be, you know, driver's license information, tax records, business information, employee information. And so what we're saying to governors and mayors is if this concerns you, if what Trump is doing with this memorandum concerns you, you can do something about it right now. And what they can do is they can sign an executive order that says, if it's a governor, my state, if it's a mayor, my municipality will not cooperate with this order. If you have any inclination that the information that you're being asked for is to go after nonprofits or charitable institutions or their donors, their members, their employees, their leaders, anyone, you are to say no. If they actually have a case to make, Let them go to judges. Let them go to the courts and convince a judge that this isn't a political witch hunt. Governors and mayors can do this right now. The ACLU has written model executive orders for governors and model executive orders for mayors. All they have to do is call up their state affiliate and ask for a copy. We'll get it to them immediately, and they can start protecting people today. But, you know, there is no single thing that any of us can do to completely wipe out the power of this presidential memorandum, but they are absolutely things that our governors and mayors can do to make it far more difficult to effectuate. And I think we all need to be asking our governors and mayors, one, do you think this is a problem? And two, do you have the courage to do something about it? And all it requires them to do is lift up the most powerful weapon in the arsenal of democracy, and that is their pens, and sign an executive order. And people will be safer the minute after they do so than they were the minute before.
That was Chad Marlowe, Senior Policy Counsel with the ACLU. This interview was previously broadcast on November 5th last year. Find more analysis and commentary on Trump's repressive National Security Memo 7 by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Robert Shetterly was one of thousands of young Americans in the late 60s and 70s who moved back to the land, becoming self-sufficient, building a home, raising food, and living off the grid. He lived in Maine and supported himself through a variety of jobs while teaching himself to paint. Eventually, Shetterly was able to make a living as a commercial artist, but almost 25 years ago, he painted a portrait of Walt Whitman to express his outrage about the U.S. government's invasion of Iraq. That set him on a course to create an ever-growing gallery of portraits called Americans Who Tell the Truth, to inspire what he calls courageous citizenship. His project, which channels the power of art to illuminate the ongoing struggle to realize America's democratic ideals, offers a variety of ways to engage with its portraits through both exhibits and educational programs. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Shetterly about his personal development as a portrait painter and discusses his goal of inspiring courageous citizenship.
My life changed in regard to this project and portrait painting in the run-up to the Iraq War right after 9/11. I was so angry, so frustrated, so alienated from this country because of the line that was going on to produce that war and the fact that the major media was letting them get away with it, that I thought I either had to leave the country or I had to do what I do best, which is paint, to somehow have a voice at that time. And I also knew, and this was very important, that it was not going to do anybody any good, me or anybody who would look at what I was doing, if I just showed how angry I was, if I just showed how full of grief I was. I realized that I had to take all that negative energy and use it in a positive way. And I couldn't, for some time, figure out what to do. And then it occurred to me, well, why don't I just surround myself with portraits of people who make me feel good about this country and good about the struggle to have this country live up to its own values. And that's where the project started. And that's when I taught myself how to paint portraits. And I began with a portrait of Walt Whitman. I thought I'd paint 5 or 6 portraits and that would be it. It was really a therapy project at the beginning, just to find a way to come to terms with being in a country that was committing war crimes. There was immediately an awful lot of people who were feeling the same nostalgia for a country they thought they lived in than I was. And soon I was getting invited to bring the portraits into schools and talk about them, go to libraries and talk about them. And it just kept growing from there.
How many have you painted up to now?
A little over 280. There are a few new ones that I haven't put up on the website yet. We have quite a team now that a little staff that works on the website and writes bios and arranges for the educational work, really made it a much bigger thing than it was originally. I mean, the portraits travel all over the country to museums and colleges and libraries and community centers, churches, as much as possible. I trundle after them and talk about who the people are and why I painted them and what they mean for all of us in terms of maintaining a level of democratic sanity. And pretty soon I was being invited places and people were paying me to speak and that kind of thing. And it gradually has developed into, I mean, I don't make much money, but I survive. And that's all I want. I mean, what I want is to be able to keep on doing this and keep painting these pictures and keep telling the stories, to, especially to kids. Because the object of it now in schools is to inspire what we call, you know, courageous citizenship, to present these models of people who are not superheroes. You know, they're regular folks with flaws in their lives who did a courageous thing or things, you know, to try to make more justice in the world.
I was scanning through them, you know, after we set up the interview. You know, I knew, I would say certainly more than half, but then there were others I didn't know. I don't know. Can you say more about the process by which you picked the people?
Sure. I mean, at the beginning, I was picking all these 19th century icons. You know, after Walt Whitman, I painted Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and Susan B. Anthony and Mother Jones and Jane Addams, you know, just like that. I mean, people that most of us know, although I was discovering that I knew them as names and I knew a name attached with an issue, but I knew nothing about their lives, really. I was, you know, having to read all these biographies to find out who these people really were and how complicated their lives often were and what their struggles were. Once this started to get a little notoriety, I was being bombarded, and I still am, with suggestions and requests. You know, why haven't you painted so-and-so? So-and-so is often somebody I've never heard of. I mean, if I look at my own gallery, I didn't know these people either. You know, I mean, I've been doing an awful lot of reading, but also I get so many suggestions, and often the suggestions are incredible about stories we should have been taught in middle school or high school or college about our own history. Because often these barely known people have had huge effects on our history.
That was Robert Shetterly, creator of the Portrait Gallery and Education Project, Americans Who Tell the Truth. This interview was previously broadcast on November 5th last year. Learn more about Shetterly's project by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KPRI in Pala, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.